to the RMBC Life podcast from Share Cancer Support, dedicated to exploring life with metastatic breast cancer from the perspective of us, the people living with this disease, and the experts who partner with us to help make our lives better. I'm Lisa Laudico, and I'm really glad you're here, since no one should face MBC alone. Today's topic might be a tough one, because there's no way to talk about it without talking about death, and our deaths in particular. However, I hope you'll stick with it, because it's also a topic of hope and our power to affect change. So if you've been in this MBC space for a while, you have unfortunately no doubt lost friends or gone through your own progression of illness. The feeling of powerlessness and despair can frankly be overwhelming at times. Even though breast cancer research is comparatively well-funded, we still don't understand all the ways metastatic cancer learns how to evade every single current treatment we have or how to stop it. But we want to talk to you today about one opportunity to do that, and that's through something called a tissue donation program. Many of us are familiar with organ donation programs, but as metastatic patients, we are sadly no longer eligible to donate our organs to another person. We can, however, donate our tissue while we're still alive and soon after we die to help researchers better understand the process of metastasis. Understanding that allows for more targeted treatments and work towards an eventual cure. So we'll talk today with patient advocates Stephanie Walker and Christine Hodgden, along with breast cancer researcher Dr. Steffi Oosterreich and clinical coordinator Lori Miller about the topic of tissue donation in general and the specific program they're all involved with called Hope for Others at the University of Pittsburgh. So we could just start with the first question. What exactly is a tissue donation program?
A tissue donation program is sometimes called a rapid autopsy program because it's happening within hours of a person's death. And their tissue, including any organs involved with metastatic breast cancer, are removed to be studied in order to advance the science towards better treatment, cure, and prevention.
So this can be a really hard topic for people. How did you all come to be involved with it? So I'll start with you, Christine.
That's a very good question. I was diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer in 2015. And before that, I was actually a caregiver to my father, who was diagnosed with a rare type of cancer in 2009. My dad passed shortly after his diagnosis. And it was very upsetting and disturbing to our family to learn that we actually could not do anything once he passed away. We asked if we could donate organs. You definitely cannot donate organs once you had cancer. And I remember just feeling very helpless that this was such a rare cancer and shouldn't we be studying it? Shouldn't we learn more about how this disease develops? And maybe then that would lead to better treatments. So I started thinking about that in 2009. And then when I was diagnosed, to be honest, when you're first diagnosed, you're not really thinking about dying. You're thinking about living. You want to live. You want to survive the disease. So I will say it wasn't something that I started thinking about right away. It took many years. Steffi and I started working together, I think on maybe a research grant, and it included this tissue donation program at Pittsburgh. And that was really where I started learning what tissue donation meant and then how valuable it was.
Absolutely. And how about for you, Stephanie?
As a nurse, I really am very passionate about tissue donation, advancing science, especially living with metastatic breast cancer. If I can donate tissue when I pass away to help somebody else years later, I'm all for it. And I think that's what we need to keep in mind, that it may not help us, but it will help someone later. And eventually, I hope that metastatic breast cancer ends up being something in the past, that it can be cured.
Thank you. And we're talking as well with Lori Miller, who's the clinical coordinator for the program. And Lori, could you talk a little bit about the common emotions that come up for people when they are thinking about participating in this?
So I think surprisingly, patients get excited. I wasn't really prepared for that. The organ donation thing is big. If you wanted to be an organ donor and you find out you can't, I think it's a big alternative and people are excited. I know that's an odd thing to say, but it's like, wow, I can still donate. I can make a huge difference. And the fear is there for some patients because you've suddenly brought up their death. But I think overall, people are very excited about this program.
Yeah, I think that what we're finding is that people, they're hungry for more information. They just weren't aware that this was even something that they could be a part of. Even in the last 5 years, we've seen more acceptance and a lot of interest. Steffi and Stephanie have presented at conferences, and I remember we had a line out the door of people having questions, right? So it was all about tissue donation and rapid autopsy, and it had speakers from different programs. And everybody was interested. But I have to say, I think the advocates were the ones that had all the questions of like, how do I enroll? How do I do this? I thought it was very wise of Steffi to really tap into the patient advocates community, because this is such a sensitive, delicate topic that it's not really appropriate for researchers, for example, to ask patients, hey, join my tissue donation program, right? That's not really appropriate. But it is appropriate as a patient to say, hey, this is something that really matters to me. I think it's really important. So mostly people are very excited. They're very interested and very eager to participate.
I mean, I know I was, but I'm also more of a science bent, right? So from the science side, it's fascinating. And from the personal side, we've talked a little bit about legacy. And this is one way that we can leave a legacy for people who come behind us. I have four nieces that I hope never have to experience breast cancer. And if there are things I can do to keep that from happening or to give them better treatments, if God forbid they do, then I'm interested. And I'm sure a lot of patients probably feel exactly the same. It's nice to have a little bit of agency in something that can make you feel so powerless sometimes. And Dr. Steffi, as a scientist, what drew you to tissue donation?
Yeah, so our team has now been studying metastatic disease for a long time, much longer than a decade, almost like 15 years. And we really focus on that. And we realized that the access to tissue from patients with metastatic disease is really what helps us to understand the disease, to understand what happened in those specific breast cancer cells. Why did they metastasize? Why were they resistant to therapy? We can do a lot with models in the lab, but to really see what's happening in the patient is absolutely critical to make impactful progress. We are very interested in why do the tumor cells lay dormant in some organs and don't grow, and the patient will die of old age, whereas somebody else, you have the same tumor cells laying at the same exact place in that organ, let's say, the liver or the lung, but then suddenly they start growing, right? To understand that, it's absolutely critical to have access to tissue from metastatic sites. So understanding organ heterogeneity, organ tropism, we call it. Why does it in one patient go to the brain and someone else only to the bone? And then somebody else, it spreads everywhere, right? Why is that? So again, to understand that, we need access to the tissue. And finally, another opportunity we have through that program is to grow the tissue in the lab. So basically to make something, what we call it an organoid or a cell line, basically representing the patient growing and having the same mutation the tumor had, right? So making models from the tissue.
So this could just be me geeking out, but it sounds like you can actually replicate tissue. Is that basically what happened? You can actually grow other tissue from tissue that's donated?
Yes, you can. You can basically take the metastatic lesion and grow it as a tiny copy, as an avatar, in a three-dimensional structure in the lab. And that is actually one of the cases where we know the longer it takes between death and start of the autopsy, the more challenging it is, because the more the cells die. This is one of those cases where you want to have live cells to grow them. But yes, that's exactly what we are doing. And you could then sequence it. You find pathways which are altered. Maybe the patient was treated with drug A and it didn't work. But in the meantime, maybe there are new drugs which come out for some of those pathways, and we could test them in that organoid. That does not bring that patient back to life, unfortunately. But again, it might help hundreds and thousands and more patients coming after the patient who donated their body.
I think that's a really helpful point, because I think as you're trying to conceptualize this as somebody who's not a scientist, who's not a pathologist, to know that you're donating a finite amount of tissue, but that finite amount of tissue can then be replicated to continue to be used, and it can go on to help a lot of different people in a lot of different ways.
And if I understand correctly, your program, which is beautifully named Hope for Others, has an example where you learned about a new pathway of resistance, an example of one way that our cancers can become resistant to the targeted treatments that are available for estrogen-positive cancers. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So in one of the autopsies we did quite a few years ago now, we did extensive sequencing. And what we learned in sequencing the metastatic tissue from one of the patients was that the estrogen receptor, which is target for hormonal therapy in approximately two-thirds of patients with breast cancer, was basically broken. Half the gene was broken off and it had fused to a different gene in the genome. We call this a fusion. It's an estrogen receptor fusion. I think what many patients have heard about are these estrogen receptor mutations, where you basically just change one tiny place in the gene of the estrogen receptor and you make it more active. And what we learned was that actually the estrogen receptor can fuse to a totally different gene, and that fusion becomes very active and totally, totally unresponsive to hormonal therapy. So it almost seems it's like the ultimate mechanism of resistance. The gene just decides, just get rid of any chance you have to basically target the estrogen receptor pathway. So we saw that because we had access to quite a large piece of tissue, we could actually do something what we call at the protein level, where we could isolate this and run this on gels and really show this indeed happens in this tissue. And we now have funding from the government, from the NCI, to really understand these estrogen receptor fusions, and we have really made progress. I think there are some of our prior trainees who now already left the lab to go somewhere else continue to study these ER fusions. So that started basically, it started a large research program, and many groups interested in this now, and I think we'll make progress very soon.
Just when we're talking about sometimes the benefits of tissue donation and rapid autopsy, one reason why I just love working with Steffi and her team is, you know, I lead lots of different initiatives around research advocacy, and one of them is around brain metastasis. And there's just so much we still don't know about brain metastasis, and even more difficult is leptomeningeal disease. So, you know, with Steffi, I can say to her, are we testing this cerebral spinal fluid to see if there's any presence of lepto? Can we look at brain tissue? And they're always game, right? Because I can say, this is something that really matters to patients. This is something that really impacts a lot of patients who are living with brain metastasis. And, you know, it doesn't have to just be brain mets. There's lots of other areas of unmet need that we can address through this type of program.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. You know, the role of the advocates, obviously, it's important for us to learn from you how to talk to patients. But the science, you know, what's important to just actually see, well, what's happening there, right? To get access to a tissue and sequence it and look, why is the disease going so fast there, right?
Yep.
So we are doing this now.
I mean, that's the beauty of working with researchers who are very receptive to ideas from patients. It's a beautiful thing when it works out.
Absolutely. We may need to have a follow-up podcast on how advocates and researchers can work together to advance tissue donation programs. But I do want to go back just for a second to the specific example that you shared, because it sounds to me like the decision of just one person, one individual deciding to donate tissue after her death, led to what sounds like almost a breakthrough in our understanding of another pathway in which our cancer becomes resistant to treatment. So one, I just want to highlight how important one person can be to this research. And also two, given that, how important is it then that you have a diversity of people who are donating tissue?
We think that is absolutely important, right? It is pretty clear that, let's say, breast cancer in a 60-year-old white woman doesn't represent all breast cancers. Right. I think to first have access to breast cancer from patients of different ages, the tumor in the young woman is really different compared to a tumor in a 70-year-old and 80-year-old woman. Getting access to tissue or having patient consented from different races and ethnicities is really important. We were very lucky. We have had a few Black patients consenting to the program. But I should say, actually be honest that in Pittsburgh, we are not that blessed with the greatest racial diversity here. I think there are other cities where hopefully we can convince them to also join the rapid autopsy program and start one there. But we have had some Black patients signing up for the program. We have had two males. Actually, our first autopsy was actually in a male patient, right? We now have somebody else consented to understand these hormone-driven diseases. How similar are they in male versus female right. breast cancer? Yeah, I think it's really important. We are very interested in different histological subtypes of breast cancer, specifically in lobular breast cancer, sometimes these mixed ductal lobular breast cancer. And maybe if I can mention this, I actually have done a podcast, an NBC podcast previously with advocate Lee Pate, who was absolutely instrumental in starting lobular breast cancer advocacy. And she was a very good friend. And I discussed this program very often. And Lee was always very into collaborations. She always wanted everybody to work together. So I'm very happy to say there is a rapid autopsy program in Belgium run by Dr. Christine Desmet, the UpTider program. And we just sent like 100 different blocks of tissues, pieces of tissue from patients with ILC to Christine. And we will work together to analyze metastatic disease from patients with ILC. The ILC affects 10 to 15% of all breast cancer. So it's important to work together and bring the resources together. Yeah.
Yeah. Also different, I would imagine, when it comes to hormone status and HER2 and triple negative as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. Specifically, HER2 positive disease, what happens in the brain, for example, triple negative in the liver and the lung, the ILC, the really unusual sites of metastasis in the ovary, in the peritoneum, leptomeningeal. So absolutely, I think the different ability to really understand the heterogeneity between molecular within molecular and histological subtypes is really important to make progress in these different types of breast cancer. Yeah, we're very happy to have Stephanie as part of this program. Mm-hmm. I think the whole idea of trusting us that we do work which is really worthwhile doing, and we have only great intentions in mind. We want to cure, we want to prevent and treat breast cancer. And I think that mistrust that might not be the case is even larger in some of the underrepresented minorities in the Black community, for example.
Very good reason.
Yes,
very good historical reason.
That's excellent. To have Stephanie as part of this and Stephanie helping us to talk to other patients is really, really important. Yeah.
And kind of to that point for you, Stephanie, as a Black metastatic breast cancer advocate and as a former hospice nurse, if you were talking to another Black woman or man living with metastatic cancer, Why might you say that donating their tissue was important, especially given the fairly recent historical betrayals of trust by parts of the scientific community and the continuing stark health inequities with big disparities between Black and white maternal mortality rates, for example, or the mortality rate in breast cancer? What advantage is there to the Black community themselves to consider donating?
Oh my gosh, there are so many reasons. Being Black, I would encourage someone to donate their tissue, to look at the statistics of Black women, men and women with advanced breast cancer. Why is it that we are diagnosed later stages of more aggressive tumors? Why is that? So another way to figure that out is to donate your tissue so that it can be studied. For an example, there's blood pressure medicine out there that was, you know, approved by the FDA, later found that it doesn't work on Black people. It does not work. With that being said, in order for us to be represented and to find out if medications work for us, if we have a different genetic makeup or our tumors act funky or different in the microenvironment, we have to have those tissues. It's not disfiguring. When you pass away and you are donating tissue, your body is respected. It is returned to the family within a reasonable amount of time, within days, but it's respected. Your family is allowed to have that memorial service or that funeral, which are very important in the Black community. It's important to further science to help my grandchildren, your great-grandchildren later on, that they don't have to go through breast cancer or prostate cancer or whatever the case may be.
Absolutely. Thank you, Stephanie. I think it's clear that the contributions and perspectives that you and Christine and other advocates are bringing to this project are invaluable. And for those who didn't have the opportunity to get to know Lee Pate, she was also a patient advocate for lobular breast cancer. And do I understand correctly, Dr. Steffi, that you actually have a picture of Lee up in the lab?
We do. I should say she actually ultimately passed from complications of ovarian cancer. She had ILC and then she had, unfortunately, she got another very aggressive disease. But in her short time working with us as an advocate, she moved mountains. And she was an avid photographer and biker. And we do have a memorial wall here on the site in the lab where we have a picture of her. And then some of the pictures she took in India and other places when she traveled on her bike. Yeah, she was amazing. This is a whole different topic, how she basically changed my life and got me reinvigorated in curing breast cancer.
If I can add to, Lee was also a dear friend. She was an inspiration for the organization I ended up co-founding, GRASP, Guiding Researchers to Scientific Partnerships. She was the original research advocate who really understood the science and was able to collaborate very closely with researchers. And when I got to tour Steffi's lab, it was just so touching to see these pictures. They're her pictures that she's taken, and there was pictures of her. And it's like a reminder to everybody working in the lab that this is why we do the work that we do. It's like an inspiration. Every day you walk by and you say that this is why. And it was just so touching to see.
That's wonderful. Yeah.
I do think that these days, to be honest, it's quite hard to get young people into the sciences and going to figure out why do we have cancer? How do we cure cancer? And it is not an easy task, not an easy job. And I think for us to get the young students engaged with patient advocates, and Yanuli was a great example. She got people excited and motivated and realized you do something which matters to hundreds and thousands of people. This is really important. It's not easy, but this is motivation to get out of bed in the morning, right? Because what you do really matters. And I think she was it. And that's the same with Christine or Stephanie or many others, right? But I think, again, this is a really important role for the advocates in that.
Yeah. I want to take us back to another question. And we talk about tissue donation as rapid autopsy. Let's talk a little bit about why the timing is so important for the value of the science.
Yeah. So we try to do it as rapid as possible. And again, Lori has really set up an amazing system to really try to have all the hands on deck and do it as fast as we can, because with every passing hour, basically after death, the tissue will just degrade. And it is harder for us to do research.
That's very helpful to know. I'm going to ask some specific questions. And one is, can you tell us, what do you mean by degraded?
Yes. So the DNA, or let's say the RNA, it's a pretty long chunk of pieces stick together, which provide genetic information. And when the cell dies, when it lyses, when it opens up, basically you let a bunch of enzymes go free, which then chop up other parts of the cell. And as a result of this, you don't have this long string, but you have little pieces of that string now. In the old days, when you wanted to sequence it, you need to have this long strand because you want to sequence along with an enzyme and get all the genetic information. Now you can take little pieces and you can sequence it. For example, what's a good example of something degrading? Christine, help me. If something falls apart, is there a good example in the kitchen of something when you can't put it back together? An egg.
I'm just seeing a piece of paper in my mind with a long coat on it. And if that piece of paper gets ripped into pieces, then you don't know necessarily the order that it was originally in. Is that an accurate?
Yes, that's absolutely perfect, Paula. That's exactly right. And these days we can do that, and we can do that much better as compared to just a few years ago. Yes. So I think if we can start all autopsies like between 3-4 hours, a maximum of 6 hours, I think that would be good.
That's very helpful. And later on in the episode, we'll talk about what programs across the country exist so that listeners can see whether or not they live within range of a tissue donation or rapid autopsy program.
I think maybe one thing I can add.
Sure.
We already mentioned the Lee Pate aspect, for example, her encouraging us to really improve understanding of metastatic cancer, her interacting with all of us and motivating us. But the other thing is, in the lab, we do have trainees who ultimately are in charge in doing the autopsy and processing the tissue. And at this point in time, we have a young man, Alex. He's an MD PhD student. He is overseeing the team right now. And Alex came to us 6 months ago or so. And he said, one thing I would like to include is really to take a pause for the team in the lab before starting the autopsy, for us to briefly discuss, okay, who was the patient, right? What happened? What was the life? There was a person, there's a human behind it. And then have a moment of silence to really recognize the humanity of the person donating the body. This is not just metastatic breast cancer coming to an end, but it's a person who lost their life to that disease. There's somebody who gives the ultimate gift. And the family agreed to it as well, right? So yeah, Alex basically put this into our SOP now that we have this remembrance of the person and for us being accountable.
I think that's so beautiful. I think it's very easy as patients to sometimes forget the humanity of people doing the work. And so even for the well-being of the scientists in the room to recognize the humanity of the person who's donated tissue, I think it's lovely. It just reminds us that we're all working towards a common goal, and that is to have better treatments, to learn how to cure breast cancer, or even beyond curing it, to prevent it. Christine?
Just going to say, my hope is that as patients are learning about tissue donation programs, that this piece that Steffi is mentioning with moments of silence and maybe a memorial service to honor these patients, I just hope that patients can just feel a little bit more at ease, knowing that the scientists are just so grateful, but then also that they're being so respectful of the body and death after their passing.
A lot of those programs, they feel like that they have to give back to the family. And a way that they do that is they do memorial services for families. Sometimes it's once a year, twice a year, they honor those families. And they're absolutely beautiful, very emotional, a lot of tears. And that's a way also that families meet other families that have gone through that and can share and support each other as well.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I like it. I'm sure that others listening will feel reassured.
Paula, you and I do both have the science interest.
Yes.
I have a background in science. So of course, I think it's very easy for us to see the benefits of this, but not everybody does. Not everybody feels comfortable. And I can understand and I very much sympathize and empathize with people who have concerns doing this. But I just think that this is great that we're talking about it so that people know that there is a lot of respect behind all of it.
Absolutely. And for our families to know that too. I think it's always a comfort. So I appreciate that. So we've talked a little bit about the process. And so Lori, I'd love to turn to you and just to ask, if a patient were interested, what is that process usually like for them?
When a patient wants to consent to the program, I make sure that we understand that the autopsy is very far in the future. That's very important to me, that they understand collecting tissue along the way and ascites and things like that is so beneficial. So I think the patients, they get excited about contributing more than just in death. Every blood draw, every time they change drugs, we check something out. We've had patients on the program since 2016 who are doing great. We have so many ascites and pleural effusions, and then the drugs work, they get better. Those are the patients that are going to make such a huge difference.
So you really are creating almost a collection of samples from one patient. I'm imagining you're able to follow progression along as it happens so that you have a much better understanding. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe I can add also that we have a lot of patients who already consent to donating tissue from the primary tumor when they have surgery of the primary tumor on the breast. And then we can also compare what's different between the primary tumor and the metastatic disease for those 20% of patients where the disease progresses to metastatic disease. Yeah, and these comparison, these what we call these paired samples, are really important to understand what changes, why does tumor become resistant.
Yes. And so, Lori, are there other points that you think is really important for anybody considering being part of a program like this?
Well, I do just think that, you know, it does give hope to people, focus, to be part of something bigger than yourself. People who join the program talk about the program a lot. They'll talk to other patients, but I really just think that patients see the value. The patients who sign up, they get it right away. So I think the important thing would be to make other patients see that.
Mm-hmm. And let's say if a patient was a little bit more hesitant, is there an ability for them to change their mind or for their families to change their minds?
Yeah, we describe it as a permission slip, not a contract. And the family can change their minds as well. And luckily, it's only happened one time where it came as such a surprise that the daughter just changed her mind. And so it does happen. But I think overall, once patients join the program, they've told their families that they are in it. And the families, they're on board. They call and they make sure that we follow hospice. And I do think the patients find this extremely valuable. The getting the word out is what's important. There's no charge for anything. We pay for transportation, and then the funeral home would just pick up at Presby rather than where the patient passes. I think that's a big deal for patients to understand that there's no charge and that we can make it quick. We make sure that we get the funeral home there quickly. But overall, it's usually just like a one-day thing.
And would that impact the ability of the patient to have a funeral or an open casket?
No, not at all. Not at all. Plunging neckline would be out, but I don't think that would affect most people. We do make the pathologist aware, though, if there's going to be an open viewing, just to make sure that we take even more care than usual, but it doesn't affect anything.
Okay. That's very good to know. I know that's a hard question, but I'm sure it's on people's minds. So I think it's important to talk about it. And are there any special preparations that a patient needs to do ahead of time? Or is it mainly hospice notifies or the family will notify?
Each patient is individual, just like each autopsy. Some families like to keep in touch because we do have a relationship over the years. Some people, as soon as they go to hospice, they want to be finished with me, which is totally understandable. Then in that case, I deal with the hospice nurse or the ICU doctor. We let the patient family drive everything, whatever they want. Some husbands will call me like every 40 minutes with an update all through the night. They just want to do it.
Yeah, I do think that speaks to the buy-in that patients feel and that their families feel. And why do you think patients buy in the way that they do?
I personally think it's a new focus. And I think it's important, especially for patients who aren't as sick. They see like the contributions they can make all along the way.
And I think both Christine and Stephanie actually consented to autopsy programs, right? You must have thought about this.
Of course, yeah. Paula, I actually think you articulated it really well, that this disease takes so much from you. There's so much that it takes. And if you're lucky to live long enough, like I have almost 10 years now with metastatic breast cancer, I'm still on treatments and I'm dealing with all these side effects, right? It just takes and takes and takes. There's just so much negative around it. And so I just think that it just gives us hope that, oh, maybe there is something positive that can come from this devastating illness. And then, of course, the ultimate goal is we learn things, we do the research, and then that evolves into treatments, and that evolves into patients living longer, and maybe one day we will eradicate breast cancer altogether. That is the ultimate goal. So I just think it's a really positive, hopeful, optimistic thing we can do that in the midst of all of this negativity and devastation of a disease.
Yeah. And even at the smallest level of that, even if we can't cure or prevent, I don't think there's words for how valuable targeted treatments are. When you and I are both on Herceptin, we know that it's not without side effects. But my side effects are so kind in comparison to many chemos. And so the better and more targeted treatments we can get for people who are living with metastatic breast cancer, even as scientists are aiming towards cure, it's not small. These are humongous benefits to people who are living with it. It makes a huge difference in the quality of our lives.
Yeah. Well, one of our first autopsies was sadly a very young woman. And I have two daughters. I remember this was one of the first times I was in the morgue and it really affected me. And I said, this is just the hardest, yeah? And then I learned from the parents that among all the misery, that the daughter signed up for the rapid autopsy program and that she was able to donate her body and the tissues, and that might help hundreds or thousands of patients later on. That gave the parents in that misery just a little tiny bit of closure, like a little bit of there might be just a tiny little bit something good coming from all this tremendous pain. But that something where the parents said, yeah, this is something we absolutely support. There's something positive which might come out of that donation of the body. Yeah.
Yeah. I always think like, please excuse my language, you get dealt a really shitty hand of cards. Like it's just a shitty hand of cards. And how can we play them in the best way that we can? And I think donating could be one way. It's not the only way, but it could be one way to bring some meaning out of things we didn't have control over happening to us. Is there anything else that you'd want patients to know about logistics?
Lori, anything else? You're on the hot seat.
I don't know if Steffi's going to agree, but I don't think we should say no to anybody, no matter how far away they are. I mean, I've helped people find programs. People call from California. I don't know where they get my name. I'll spend half a day. I just want to make a difference for the patients. They don't have to be in Pittsburgh. I just don't want people who are like 4.5 hours away not to reach out. Still reach out and we can hopefully figure something out. I just don't want the distance to be an issue. But once we talk about the 11 programs around the country, hopefully we can help.
So let's do that. So if a listener were interested and wanted to find out more, how would they do that? Does Hope for Others have a website?
Hope for Others does have a website, and the website is very easy, ourhopeforothers.org. And on that website, you can learn a lot about the Pittsburgh Tissue Donation Program, but we also just give a lot of general information. As I mentioned, we're trying to raise awareness about tissue donation and rapid autopsy, period. Not trying to promote the Pittsburgh program over others. We want people to just be aware that it exists. Also on this website, we will include the verified tissue donation programs that exist around the country. And so far, we have 11 verified. There's likely many more, but that's where we're starting. And some of them are pan-tumor, but these all allow for breast cancer patients to participate.
That's great. And do you mind actually just telling us what cities they're located in?
Of course. Duarte, California, Palo Alto, California, New Haven, Connecticut, Bethesda, Maryland, Baltimore, Maryland, New York, New York, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Columbus, Ohio, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Houston, Texas, and Salt Lake City, Utah.
That's great. Thank you. And interior of the country, we see you. Mm-hmm. We know there's often not enough resources for you, and people are continuing to work on that. But if you live on a coast, there may be a place that you can connect with and donate if you feel so led.
And Stephanie, I know that cancer care in rural areas is very close to your heart. Are there any special considerations for people living in more rural areas when it comes to donating tissue?
Living in a rural community and tissue donation, it should not be any more difficult than living in the suburbs or living close to a university-based facility that has a program. And that's the key, if they have a program. These programs aren't at every hospital. They're not at every major teaching institution or NCI-designated center. We are actually trying to expand that. And part of that is to share the information that I have with other advocates who may be interested. And if they don't have a program at their facility, maybe be able to even inquire about it or to have that program there. I thought I didn't qualify living in a rural community. And when I inquired at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, they were, yes, you do. You're in the area that you can participate. I was really surprised because it's the miles that they utilize is as the crow flies, not highway miles. So I did enroll at UNC Chapel Hill, being in a rural community. And people in rural communities get their cancer care usually at a community cancer center. And a lot of times they're not going to have that information on tissue donation. So, you know, that's a disadvantage to people living in rural communities that they're not getting the information, not only about tissue donation, but about clinical trials too. We just have to figure out a way when those programs are available close by that that information does filter down to community cancer centers as well. A lot of work, truly a lot of work to be done in this space. And I think it can be done, providing that we get a lot of advocates, our patients, to talk about it and to inquire about it, because it needs to be discussed. It needs to be out there.
Absolutely. So advocates, if you're out there and you're interested, please reach out to Stephanie and to Christine to talk about how you might be able to become involved in this.
Christine, maybe you want to share that email with a listener of the program.
The email, if you want to reach out to us, if you have any questions, if you're running a rapid autopsy program that's not listed in our verified list, just don't hesitate to reach out to us at hopeforothers@pitt.edu. And that's PITT.edu.
So the last question is really just an opportunity for all of you to kind of give a final summary statement to listeners.
Yeah, I would like to make two statements. One is I would like to thank everybody. I just thank the research team and Lori and the advocates, but I would like to thank all the patients and their families, that they, whoever has already consented, who will consent in the future, we are so grateful for that, for you to basically give the ultimate gift to help other patients behind you to hopefully not suffer from the disease like they did. Yeah. So that I really am super, super grateful to all the patients and the families. And yeah. And the second is that I do hope, and I'm really convinced with us doing our piece to normalizing the program, with hopefully other programs coming into activity in other cities, I do hope that we will learn more and cure the disease. I do think these rapid autopsy programs will be an absolutely critical, necessary part for improving outcome for metastatic breast cancer.
I can say that I also want to normalize this the way organ donation is normalized. I think that it's very easy for us to say, yes, I would like to be an organ donor. Like, we see the benefit in that instantly. And this is no different. You're donating your organs. It's just not going to another person. It's going to advance research. And I think that the difference is that it's maybe not so instantaneous the way it is with organ donation. So I always see these tearful videos of people meeting a person that has the heart of their son that passed away, right? Like, it's an immediate benefit because this person can now live with a new heart. We don't quite have that immediate benefit because research takes time. But I think that if we can help patients understand that it's the same thing, it's just we're not giving it to another person, it's to research.
Yeah, not just one person, but to hundreds and thousands of people, really is what it is.
To sum it all up, as a Black woman living in a rural community regarding tissue donation, I would stress that everybody, Black, brown, blue, green, or white, inquire about a tissue donation program at their facility or to consider donating your tissues to advance science for a cure for metastatic breast cancer. If not for us, for our children, grandchildren, the neighbor's kids, to find a way to have better treatments, more Black people be more responsive to their treatments, and try to figure out why we continually die a lot sooner than our counterparts living with the same disease.
Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you. And Lori, I wanted to give you a chance. I don't know if you have a closing statement. It's okay if you don't.
I think helping patients with the legacy it's priceless for me. I really believe that it helps the families to know that their loved one, it's a legacy for real. It is truly, it will never go away and they'll always be part of this. And I think what I didn't expect is that every single autopsy has been different. I just don't know why that surprised me. I thought it would be sort of routine, but you're not just going to be like another number. Every single case has been so unique, and I think that people should know that because you specifically matter.
Lori, I don't think there could be a better closing statement than that. Every single one of us matters. Every single one of us can do something to impact this disease. Thank you so much to Dr. Steffi Oosterijk, to her partner, Dr. Lee, to Lori, Stephanie, and Christine, and to all the other researchers and advocates who work every day to help us better understand metastatic disease and what we can do to stop it. And thanks to you for listening and hanging in with what might have been a challenging topic. I hope it was helpful to you. This episode was produced by myself, Paula Jane, with sound design by our associate producer, Connor Kinsley. Many thanks to Miranda Gonzalez and to Kate Fitzer for keeping us all on schedule. Our executive producer is Christine Benjamin, Vice President of Patient Support and Education at Share Cancer Support. You can find more episodes of RNBC Life wherever you listen to your podcasts. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review. Please check out our blog and full episode notes on our website, rnbclife.org, and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and X at RNBC Life. Thank you.